Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Eastern Rug Gallery at 1402 South Neal in Champaign, offering guaranteed hand-knotted Oriental and Persian rugs of all sizes, made of pure wool or silk pile. Since 1992, Eastern Rug Gallery has provided cleaning, repair, and restoration of handmade rugs.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for the show, Harriet Williams and Martha Deal, and Henry Frayton is at the controls this morning. For a big chunk of human history, people had stories to explain some of the big cosmic questions. Questions like, where did the universe come from? Where is it going? Where do we, as human beings, fit in? And most of those stories, these stories that people told for a long time, most of the stories put us, put human beings and the Earth at the center of the universe. Then, when modern astronomy was born, we started having better tools to look out and gain a better understanding of the universe. We suddenly came to the shocking realization that we were not at the center of the universe, that in fact the Earth was just another rock in a big collection of rocks floating in the vastness of space. And among other things, that made us feel very small. Well, this morning we'll have two guests who make the argument that recent science has given us a new story, one that once again places us in the center, perhaps now not in the center geographically, but in the center in some surprising and interesting ways. Our guests this morning are Joel Primack and Nancy Ellen Abrams, and together they have authored a book. It's titled The View from the Center of the Universe, Discovering Our Extraordinary Place in the Cosmos. It is published by Riverhead Books, and it has just recently been published. Our guests, Joel Primack, is professor of physics at the University of California at Santa Cruz and has done some of the foundational research in the field of cosmology. Nancy Ellen Abrams is a lawyer, a writer. She's also a former Fulbright scholar who has been interested for a long time in history, philosophy, and politics of science. She worked on the staff of Congress, and when she was doing that, she was involved in creating a method that would give government agencies the tools to make good policy decisions in cases where there was some scientific uncertainty. She's also consulted on that for the government of Sweden, for several state governments, and for various corporations. And she's contributed articles to a number of magazines and books. The two of them are joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, questions certainly are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that they try to keep their comments brief so that we can keep our program moving along and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone's welcome to call. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. So either way, whichever one works for you, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana where we are, use the first one, 333-9455. And anywhere else you might be listening, around Illinois and Indiana, or if you're listening on the internet in the United States, anywhere, use that toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Well, Joel Primack, hello.
Hello.
And Nancy Abrams, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Well, good morning to both of you. Thanks very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate that.
You're so welcome.
And you're now in the engaged on the tour, traveling around the country talking about the book? Yet?
Yeah, indeed.
All right, good. And you're in California, I think?
Yeah, today we're in Santa Cruz, our hometown.
All right. Okay, very good. Well, again, I much appreciate you being with us. Let me ask you a basic question, one that really underlies the whole effort of writing the book, and that is, given the fact that science did give us this understanding that says, among other things, that says, no, the Earth is not the center of the universe, and that it's big and it's complex and we're just one small part, and that tended to undercut some of the kinds of more traditional cosmologies, the ways that people tried to understand their place in the universe, and led to some people feeling very, very small and alone and insignificant. Why do you think now, and why is that, why should anybody really be uncomfortable with that? Perhaps that's the question. And why is it that we need to have a story, something like the older stories, to be able to tell ourselves about why it is we're here and what our place in the vastness of the universe is. I mean, why do we need it?
Everybody wants to feel connected to something larger than they are, because that's really the source of meaning in our lives. It's the reason why people have religions, and it's the reason why people want to be part of a larger group and part of a country. And they want to identify with something. They need to find their meaning in being part of something significant. We have had a hard time feeling part of the universe for the past four centuries, and the reason was that we could feel central to the universe when we didn't have to have any scientific standards that told us that our picture of the universe was true. And until the Copernican Revolution, when people felt that they were the center of the universe, there really was nobody arguing, yes, but scientifically, that's not true. Once we had scientific standards, we couldn't meet them. We couldn't find a picture of ourselves where we're central. Now, the amazing thing is that we are turning out to be central in very subtle and interesting ways. It matters to people because our identity is determined by our understanding of where we come from. If all we understand is some very, very small amount of where we come from, our background and so on, who we think of ourselves as is really quite small. But as we start to see ourselves fitting into the universe as a whole, we start realizing that we have a tremendous and fascinating cosmic identity. And that may sound, you know, sort of airy-fairy, but it's not. The word cosmic is a genuinely important scientific term. And we now are learning much more about who we are, how we can identify with our larger selves, and also what brings all of us humans together. This is something that unites us all.
Hmm. When I first took a look at the book before I tried to get into it, and I guess I was thinking that when you were talking about restoring this notion of centrality, that it was kind of metaphorical. And I realize as I look at the book more and more that, in fact, no, you're not talking about metaphor. You're talking about ways in which we are, in fact, at the middle. In, for example, one of the things that you talk about, and I know that I'm greatly oversimplifying perhaps the argument that you're making, but if you look at all of the stuff that's in the universe that we know about, you look at and the range of things from the smallest things to the biggest things. Your argument is that, in fact, human beings really are in the middle. We really are in the center of that continuum.
That's right. Not only that, it turns out there's a smallest size. Physicists call this the Planck length, and it's determined by the interplay of relativity and quantum theory. And there's a largest size, at least, that we can actually see, and that's the size of the whole universe, the distance to what we call the cosmic horizon. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, the human scale is right in the middle between those two limits. Moreover, that's the only size that we could possibly be. We couldn't be significantly smaller than we are because all atoms are about the same size, and it takes an awful lot of atoms to make something as complicated as the human brain. That's the most complicated thing that we have ever discovered. That's the pinnacle in our known universe of complexity. Mm-hmm. And you might think, well, of course we could be a lot larger. If we find aliens, they might be a lot smarter than us because they're a lot larger. They have really big brains. That's also not likely to be correct. And the reason is that the bigger a thinking machine is, the slower its communication has to be, ultimately because of the speed of light as an ultimate speed limit. If you want to build a supercomputer, you hook together a lot of small processors which do all the hard computation, and the links between them are actually the thing that makes the thing slow. And it would be the same with some large organism. If it were really big, you know, the size of a planet or the size of a mountain, it would be a collection, a community, if you like, of minds. But the individual thinking organisms would be roughly our size.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I can imagine people reacting to this in a couple of different ways. One would be to say, well, actually, that's sort of comforting because it takes us a few steps away from this idea that human beings are just some kind of accident. It says that, well, in fact, something about us makes sense that we are as we are because of what we know about the laws of physics. On the other hand, I could also imagine people looking back at this idea that the centrality of big and small and how we're in the middle and how, in fact, it sort of makes sense that we're in the middle. Still people looking at that and saying, well, that's very interesting, but so what? What really does that mean? It's not quite the same thing as saying that the Earth is the center of the universe.
Well, the meaning of our centrality is not a question that science can answer. We make this really very clear in our book. Science can point out to us at least 7 different ways that we're central, not just the one you mentioned, but also, for example, the fact that we're made of the rarest material in the universe and several other ways. But once we point these things out as arising from the basic principles of physics and cosmology, the question of, well, what does it mean and does it matter, is not a scientific question. And we do, in our book, go well beyond the science, but we point out where we're going beyond the science because it is important to realize that these are cultural choices, how we interpret these things, whether we find it important that we're central or whether we want to poo-poo it. There is a certain attitude that many, many people have toward the universe, especially many scientifically oriented people who are used to the idea that we're not the center of the universe. Galileo was right, we're just a rock, as you characterized this earlier, you know, flying around the sun. And that has been developed into this kind of existential view where we just create any meaning that works for us and we're alone in the universe and let's make something out of it because there really isn't anything fundamentally to it. That has been a legitimate point of view, but it doesn't have to be the point of view we choose anymore. And to a great extent, it is inaccurate because that point of view basically sees the universe as out there and we're here studying it objectively. We're not studying the universe objectively. We are the universe. Every one of us is what the Big Bang is doing right now, right where we are. We need to start seeing the modern universe as something that encompasses us. We are here. We have a place in it. If we can't explain the universe as including us, then we've got an inaccurate picture of the universe. And now, for the first time, we actually have the scientific background. We have a new scientific picture of the universe that does include us. So, yes, we can choose to still have some sort of an existential attitude toward it, but it no longer serves us to do that.
Well, is it that you're arguing that as we gain a better and better understanding of the mechanics of the universe, questions of how is it that it works, that then does that understanding, can we somehow apply that to this other question, the meaning question, the other that perhaps it's not the kind of thing that's quite so amenable to science? I mean, are those two things connected?
We can connect them. As Nancy was saying, we're not obliged to. If you want to take the existential stance and you like your angst, who are we to tell you otherwise? All we can do is point out that there are some things you might not have considered in deciding which attitude to adopt. One of them is that we really are central or special in lots of interesting ways that science is teaching us. But another is that the attitude that you take can affect what you decide to do, even with your life. If you think that we're just an insignificant mote in an enormous universe that doesn't know or care about us, then you may say, well, the future of the Earth, it doesn't really matter. On the other hand, if your attitude is that the Earth is extraordinarily precious because it is so rare, there's nothing like it in the known universe, and similarly for human beings, then you may be motivated to take some steps to protect our precious planet. So there are larger implications to this choice. On the other hand, I have to say, our book is mostly a science book. Most of the book is trying to describe the modern picture of the universe in interesting new ways that make it accessible. We try to use symbols rather than graphs. Symbols are things that you can hold in your mind and examine from different points of view. And they summarize a lot of information. And in fact, we try to use symbols that have some historical resonance. We sort of recycle some ancient symbols and give them new scientific meaning. And we also have other ways of trying to make the modern universe accessible to people who don't know a lot about the basic science. And we also try to include a lot of important science, but we do it in endnotes, so the text isn't interrupted unless you want to find out more. So the book is really a science book, but at the end, we talk about these things that we're talking about now, which is, so what difference does it make to us as individual people and to our culture, to the developing world culture, for which the new science is going to provide the only possible shared picture of reality?
Our guests in this second hour of Focus 580, Joel Primack and Nancy Ellen Abrams. Joel Primack is professor of physics at the University of California at Santa Cruz and someone who has done a lot of the basic research, the foundational research in cosmology. Nancy Ellen Abrams is lawyer, writer, former Fulbright scholar. The two of them together for a decade have been co-teaching a course at the University of California, Santa Cruz called Cosmology and Culture, from which the book developed. And again, if you'd like to look at the book, it's title is The View from the Center of the Universe. It's published by Riverhead Books. We have a caller and would welcome others. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here this caller is over in Indiana, next door, line number 4. Hello.
Hello. There for a quick instant, I thought I was back in Florence. This is all Renaissance kind of stuff. In fact, there's a famous print that shows man as the center of the universe. Of course, you have to make distinctions about the period of science and things. But I think if you were at this level now where you're talking about the things you are now, you should be able to make predictions in terms of what we know about the universe. The girl mentioned about rare earths sort of thing inside humans. We should be at a place where we can start doing things mathematically besides this sort of, in philosophy, be a god in every niche. It seems like this is what might go for the popular culture. But I'm more interested in the mathematics part of it. If you're at that stage now, you should start making predictions about at least the size or mass and height and things of other animals we might find someplace else. You scratched that when you talked about the relationship between the human mind and the body, and what could happen for larger animals that would not occur. Thanks.
All right.
So the question, as I understand it, is what sort of predictions does the modern scientific picture make about the nature of possible alien beings? Thanks for asking. We have a whole chapter on that. Let me just mention one example, because we can't summarize the whole chapter briefly, but this one is particularly startling to many people. One of the things that was discovered quite some time ago in the 1930s about the nature of large living organisms on Earth is something called allometry. This is scaling relations. It turns out, for example, that the heart rate of all mammals scales as a certain power of their mass, so that the larger the animal is, the slower the heart. It's also true that the lifespan scales as a power of the mass, but in this case, the larger the animal is, the longer they live. A consequence is that the number of heartbeats that any mammal has is a constant. It's a certain number. It's about a billion. Humans, incidentally, have about 2 billion, and that may be because of modern medicine and good public health. But anyway, within small factors like 2, this is a universal fact. Incidentally, it's also true for other kinds of animals, like birds. The number of heartbeats is larger for birds, but the fact that all birds, from tiny ones to great big ones, have the same number of heartbeats, and all mammals, from tree shrews, 3 centimeters long, to giant whales, have the same number of heartbeats, that's a remarkable regularity. It turns out to follow from the fact that all atoms are the same size, cells in a large organism are about the same size, together with the fact that the circulatory system has to reach every cell in any organism, and so it has to be what we call a space-filling curve. It's a kind of fractal. And from those two assumptions, plus the laws of physics, you can deduce that these scaling relations have to hold. Now, everything I just said is going to be true on an alien world. So this fact should be true every place in the universe. That means that we actually know something about the organization of large creatures anywhere in the universe, and maybe even something about their lifespans. They might be pretty close to ours. Now, this is just an example of the sort of new information that science is providing. And it's a strong prediction. On the other hand, until we actually find some of these hypothetical alien creatures, we aren't going to be able to test that prediction. Of course, we scientists have some great ideas for how to look for them, and we may not have to do it with spaceships. Of course, we can look for radio waves, but we have some really great new ideas for how to do it. There's something called the Terrestrial Planet Finder, a program that NASA has been looking into, but unfortunately has been postponing because some people think that we should put people back on the moon first.
So you're ultimately here, the way that you weigh in on this question, one of the questions that everyone asks and is curious about, the question being, are we alone in the universe or are there living things elsewhere? You would weigh on the question, weigh in on the side of those people would say yes. Yes, they're in all probability, in very high probability, that we are not alone.
Well, we don't really know what the probabilities are. And in fact, we discuss the current state of scientific arguments on that and summarize two very different viewpoints. One, that we're an extremely unlikely planet, a rare Earth, as Ward and Brownlee in their book call it. And on the other hand, the likelihood that the sort of evolution that's occurred on Earth is likely to happen on other planets, or if you rewind the tape, as Gould likes to say, he would say the chances of having humans come along again are infinitesimal, but other people argue exactly the opposite. So we try to summarize the arguments. But the fact is, it's a scientific question, and we should answer it scientifically by going out and looking and doing experiments. There are basically two approaches. One, everybody knows about, the SETI approach, is to try to find signals from other intelligent civilizations on distant worlds. And there's going to be a tremendous improvement when the new Allen array of radio telescopes goes into operation very soon. We're going to be looking at 1,000 times as many possible planet civilizations. So that's a tremendous increase. It's going to happen in the next few years, and maybe we'll discover something. Mm-hmm. The other approach is to study carefully how life evolved on Earth, try to understand life better. And that's the sort of thing I was just describing a minute ago. Understanding these scaling relations that tell us that all mammals have about the same number of heartbeats as just a consequence of the laws of physics basically tells us something about life anywhere in the universe. So both approaches are valid, and I think this is a wonderful time to be thinking about these subjects because we're making such great progress on both.
Well, you mentioned that this basically is a science book, and it is, an attempt to try to relate to what is now the state of the art of thinking, what we know now about the universe, and to put that across in a way that people who are not scientists will understand. And I think you've done a pretty good job on that, and you don't have to be an astrophysicist to get anything out of this book.
So thank you.
Maybe let me ask you a couple of basic things about the big questions that you discuss. And one of them has to do with the stuff out of which the universe is made. Partly we know about what some of the stuff is because it's the stuff that we're made out of. But also, and again, I realize that maybe this is oversimplifying things, but as I understand it, one of the puzzles that cosmologists have wrestled with has to do with the fact that all that we can see is obviously not all that's there. There clearly are things there that in the universe that we can't see. And so then for a long time, one of the big and most interesting questions was, well, what is it? What is this stuff? Do we now have a better understanding, do you think, of the material in the universe that is not this stuff that we can see and that we readily know about, all, you know, for example, all those things that are on the periodic table that we all were frightened of by probably in chemistry class?
Let me answer very briefly. First of all the stars and planets and gas and dust, everything we can see in the universe adds up to about 0.5%, half a percent of what's really out there. So astronomers for a long time thought that their problem was to understand what they see. But now it turns out that the big problem is to understand what we don't see. Most of the universe is completely invisible. So then the question is, all right, so what is it made of? And we've learned a lot. We know what the basic cosmic recipe is. There's about 4.5% of atoms. There's half a percent that we see and another roughly 4% that must be out in between the galaxies because we don't see it, but we know it's there. We can measure it at least four independent ways, and we always get the same answer. Then there's the matter that actually holds the galaxies together, and that's what we call cold, dark matter. I was the one who actually introduced that terminology, and it caught on back in the early 80s. There were several different possibilities: hot dark matter, warm dark matter, cold dark matter, we called them. And in fact, in the early 80s, the popular one was hot dark matter, which would be light particles like neutrinos. Now we know that doesn't work, and we're pretty sure that warm dark matter doesn't work either. But cold dark matter just goes from success to success. It made very detailed predictions about the heat from the cosmic background radiation, the heat radiation of the Big Bang. It turns out there's slightly different temperatures in different directions. And the way that works was predicted by the theory, and it's been confirmed in incredible detail. Also, the distribution of the galaxies on large scales and properties of galaxies. These things are predicted by the theory, and the confirmations are really stunning. They're in very great detail. The decimal places are all coming in as predicted. So you have to take the theory very seriously. Now, you may wonder, so what is this stuff? Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I have to confess, we don't know yet. We know about its properties, but we don't know what the actual stuff is, the material that is holding our galaxy and all the other big galaxies together, this cold, dark matter stuff. A lot of people think that it's a kind of particle that I proposed along with the late Heinz Pagels back in the early 1980s. It's connected with a theory called supersymmetry, which is the main theory that tries to go beyond what we currently understand. If you've heard of string theory, that's superstring theory, and it's based on supersymmetry. So if string theory is right, then this idea is probably right, that the dark matter particles are the lightest particle connected with this supersymmetry idea. If that's true, we should discover them in the next few years. There's going to be a new, very powerful atom smasher called the Large Hadron Collider going into operation in Geneva, Switzerland, next July. So if the current theories are right, very likely that machine is going to start making this dark matter on Earth. We'll find that out because a lot of energy and momentum will be mysteriously disappearing from the apparatus. These dark matter particles are invisible, and they'll fly out of the apparatus, but they'll carry away a lot of energy. And by seeing what we don't see, we'll learn the nature of these particles. So that's one example. There are actually two different ways, which are also extremely promising for looking for the dark matter particles. Incidentally, another name that's often given to these dark matter particles, which was coined by some physicists, including Mike Turner, working at the University of Chicago, is WIMPs, Weakly Interacting Massive Particles. It's the same idea. It's a lovely name because these particles, although they're very massive, will mostly just go right through us and everything else. They're kind of wimpy. The vast bulk of the stuff in the universe is not any of the things I've just mentioned. It's something called dark energy, and that's genuinely mysterious. The thing we know about it is that it makes space repel space, and it's the thing that powers the Big Bang. It's making the universe expand faster and faster now. So we know, again, a lot about what it does, but that's perhaps the greatest mystery that cosmology has revealed. We don't know what this stuff is. We'd love to find out. We've got some very clever ways to do it, but it's going to take a little bit more research and a little bit more money. Hmm. Anyway, that's the cosmic recipe. Let me just mention one thing, though. What we're made of, those heavy elements in the periodic table that you mentioned, that represents a hundredth of 1%, a ten-thousandth of the universe. That's what we're made of. We're made of those heavy elements, carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, phosphorus, sulfur, iron, things like that. Every one of those atoms is made deep in stars. We are made of star stuff.
Ms. Abrams, I know you live with this man, so you must have the opportunity to have these kind of discussions all the time, but do you get this? I mean, really, I find myself thinking every time I have an opportunity to have a conversation like this, I say, well, I'm going to do it in the hope that eventually I'll start to understand. And I'm not really sure that I do. I'm not really sure that I do yet. Maybe, who knows, someday. And it's not the fault of the explainers, I'm sure. It's mostly on my side. How well do you think that you understand the kind of stuff that people like Professor Primack are involved in?
Well, Joel and I have been married for almost 29 years. So, yes, I've actually lived through the discovery of this entire picture. I've been involved right from the start. I knew Joel before he was even into astronomy. He was just a particle physicist, and then he moved into astronomy and astrophysics and so forth. So, yes, I've lived through the whole process with him. I'm not a scientist, but I did actually major in the history and philosophy of science when I was an undergraduate at the University of Chicago. And I have been interested in these things since before I met Joel. So it's been absolutely wonderful for me to be able to follow the development of this amazing cosmological revolution that we're in now. You know, there are things that he explains to me that he has to explain several times before I get it, of course. But the fact is, and this is what I really hope everybody listening to your show gets, you do not have to be a scientist to understand these theories, any more than you have to be an auto mechanic to drive your car. This universe belongs to all of us, and if it's simply expressed in a way that's accessible to people, which is what we've tried to do in our book, you can understand these ideas even without understanding the mathematics underlying them, although we certainly give you enough evidence so that you should be convinced to the extent of the evidence. We even lay out what the extent of the evidence is for every theory we talk about. So the idea is that we have this wonderful emerging new picture. Yes, there are experts. It takes experts to figure it out. But we don't have to figure it out. It's been figured out by the experts. Now all we have to do is appreciate it and start to see what the implications are for our own lives. I think that's very exciting.
Our guests in this hour of Focus, Joel Primack and Nancy Ellen Abrams. Joel Primack is professor of physics at the University of California at Santa Cruz. Nancy Ellen Abrams is lawyer, writer, former Fulbright scholar with a long-term interest in history, philosophy, and politics of science. For a decade, the two of them have been co-teaching a course at the university there at Santa Cruz called Cosmology and Culture, from which the book that we're talking about this morning has developed. And if you would like to read it, you can find it, I'm sure, in the bookstore. It's titled The View from the Center of the Universe, Discovering Our Extraordinary Place in the Cosmos, and it's published by Riverhead Books. And we do have a couple of callers here to bring into the conversation. Next, we'll talk with someone in Belgium nearby, line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. First, I must commend you folks on living on a very pretty spot. I go to Central California several times a year, and I do find the Monterey Bay Area very, very attractive. Lovely place to live. But to go on with a little bit more of my history, as a young man, I worked for the University of Illinois, and I built a radio telescope over here at the end of the world, at the road end, and we had this telescope that was dug into the ground, and we listened to the stars, and we built another one that we used to travel the sky. And I used to be a cosmologist that used to come here on a very regular basis, and I always talked to him. And he went along and spoke about similar sort of things. This was many years ago, and some things have changed since then, for sure. Longer than you've been married, actually. And the thing that I always ask him about, and deals with the homocentricity of our species, is this, and I'm just going to use an example because I can't really put it in too many better words than an example. We have pets, okay, an animal, a dog, whatever that pet we want, and we always assume that that pet thinks of us like a human would think of us. In other words, putting every animal, every species, everything in context that makes us think about it as ourselves and more like ourselves. Now, isn't that a possibility of the problem you're dealing with right here? We think so much of ourselves that we're not really looking past ourselves to see what maybe might be?
I think that the thing that you're talking about in attributing human characters to animals is certainly something that humans do. Psychologists say that this imputation of agency, that's the kind of terminology psychologists would use, comes naturally to people because one of the things that distinguishes people from other animals, at least aside from some of the higher primates, is that we have a theory of mind. In other words, we can understand that other people will have thoughts in their minds, and we can even understand that those thoughts might be wrong. For example, that they might be lying to us. This kind of trickery is something that humans have to understand in order to live in societies and deal with other people. And it's one of our proudest achievements, but we do have a tendency to look at other creatures as having the same sorts of characteristics that humans do, and in fact, not even creatures, but inanimate objects. And this is, according to psychologists, the reason that people worship idols, for example.
Exactly.
Anyway, one of the glories of modern psychology is that people do experiments and try to understand just what it is that animals can and can't do. For example, it turns out that chimpanzees, some of the smartest creatures on Earth aside from humans, can't do the sort of thing that any human child can do. Namely, they can learn by watching other people watching other people or imitating other people. Chimps don't do that. Chimps can do second-order things, but not third-order things. This is a piece of research that was done by my cousin, David Premack, another psychologist. So although many people may not understand what modern psychology is learning, this is the sort of thing that we're actually able to discover by doing experiments. Something that just appeared in the news that I'll have to learn more about is that dolphins may be able to do much more than chimps can. It seems that they call each other by names and even have conversations about other dolphins. If that's really true, then the other really smart social animal on Earth may be dolphins. But in any case, these are the sorts of questions that you have to answer. The nature of society, the sorts of discourses that the creatures can have. If you want to understand the level of development of other organisms, and of course, rather than just studying organisms far away in space, we do well to study other smart creatures on Earth, like birds and even cephalopods.
Well, that's precisely what I'm getting at, sir, that we sometimes fool ourselves into thinking that we know all that we know, when in actuality we may very easily be looking by something that we thought we had right. Just like Copernicus, you know. He was able to see something that everybody else kind of fooled themselves with. And same way with dolphins. And there's some monkeys that learn how to wash their food and learn from other monkeys that that's what they should do to make things better. There's many examples of where other animals learn too. And I'm just always wondering that maybe we're just too smart by half. You know what I mean?
Well, the example of monkey culture, namely that several of the higher primates actually learn by example and can pass these things on, and whole groups of them share that. This, of course, is a discovery of modern science. And I think we're in agreement that we have to study other creatures on Earth very carefully to understand how they work. The science of ethology, studying animal behavior, was invented by Conrad Lorenz and his friends not a century ago. I mean, it was in the 30s and 40s. And we've come a long way since then, and we obviously have a long way to go. And isn't it great?
Yes, it is.
What we're trying to do, those of us who are trying to organize our information into the sort of big picture, we humans are unusual in modern civilization in that we don't have a shared picture of reality. All of the cultures that preceded the modern culture up through the Middle Ages had a shared picture of reality. If you asked anybody in Europe or, for that matter, North Africa or the Middle East for 1,000 years how the universe was organized, they'd all answer exactly the same thing. Earth is at the center, surrounded by spheres carrying the planets and the stars. That was the shared picture of reality. It was wrong, but everybody agreed on it. And that's the basis of their whole culture. That's the way most cultures have been organized in history. We're an unusual period in that for 400 years we haven't had such a shared picture. Ever since Galileo and the other scientists who began the Renaissance overthrew that medieval picture. But now, scientists working in many different fields are creating the basis for a new shared picture of reality. And it's none too soon.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We have 7 or 8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Professor Premack, have I been mispronouncing your name all along?
Yes, it's Premack.
I'm very
but
sorry.
But lots of other people call me Primack, and I'll be glad to answer.
Well, I don't know. As someone who's gone through life having my name mispronounced, I guess I try to make a good faith effort at getting people's names right. Our guests are Joel Premack. He's professor of physics at University of California, Santa Cruz, and Nancy Ellen Abramson. Again, the book is entitled View from the Center of the Universe. Let's go next to someone in Atlanta, Illinois, in line number one. Hello.
Interesting. I've got a question for you. I grew up in a scientific family and have tried to somewhat base my thoughts on science as far as manipulating my way through this life, and which has caused me to be an extreme environmentalist as far as trying to take care of this planet so it can last as long as it possibly can, and so as many species and peoples can have, which are species also, have some kind of experience that we, you know, this is a phenomenal thing that we're all expecting.
More power to you.
And my question is, so being from a scientific family, we all have to realize that someday this planet's going to die. And so from a science point of view, you know, in my family, knowledge was gathered over the, you know, the whole time of my life till my father died, and you're gathering information and everything. Is there any thoughts about, at some point in time, to make sure that all the information that humans have been able, science, that humans, which is obviously going to get better and better, as you've alluded to, as we go along here, and we're going to know more and more, is there any thoughts in the scientific community to be able to pass this on through some kind of technology that might not even be thought of yet, to so that it's out there?
Sure. There are a lot of interesting ideas of that sort. There's a project to build deep underground a clock that will basically work for an extremely long period, things of this sort. Let me comment very briefly on two aspects of your question. The sun is going to turn into a red giant star in 5 or 6 billion years. It'll swallow the inner planets and probably burn Earth to a crisp. But a little sooner than that, in about 500 million years, the sun's increasing output of heat and light will make the Earth a pretty unlivable place, unless we can move the Earth further away from the sun, which actually could be done by changing the orbits of some large comets. But what that means is that we're living in the middle of the best period of Earth. The Earth got an oxygen-rich atmosphere about 500 million years ago, and the Earth will be perfectly livable for about another 500 million years before it starts to overheat. That means that we have literally millions of generations, hundreds of millions of years, before the problems that are caused by basically the way the cosmos works make the Earth a very difficult environment. We've got a much shorter time scale that we have to worry about, and that's what you were alluding to by mentioning these environmental problems. We humans are at the end of a phase of our development. We can call it the exponential phase or the inflationary phase, during which we doubled our numbers and redoubled and redoubled. There aren't going to be any more doublings. We've reached the end of that line. Hardly anybody who studied it thinks that the Earth can support twice the number of people it has now. The question is whether it can support that number. Fortunately, we're bringing our population under control. The population growth rate peaked in the mid-70s, and it's actually been coming down since then. But we're still increasing our impact on the planet, and that has to be brought under control very rapidly. So rather than somehow trying to preserve the knowledge that we've been able to achieve so far, and also our great literature and art and so forth, that's important. We have museums and so forth to try to do that. I think our big problem is making this transition in a way that leaves the Earth in good shape for the next generation and the generation after that and the many generations that should follow that, for humans and for all the other creatures on Earth. I think this is a goal that you share and that we should all share.
Well, I agree with you, 100%, and have spent a lifetime trying to head toward that goal. That's right. But there could be other possibilities. Man himself, like Mars in particular, there was catastrophic evidence that maybe there was an atmosphere there that the atmosphere deserted the planet at some point in time, and of course that isn't good. And there's theories that due to the way humans have interacted on this planet, that there is possibilities that in a relatively short time, maybe hundreds of years or maybe thousands, that the atmosphere, due to if we don't get things under control here, could desert this planet. So there's possibilities that this planet could come to a close sooner than, the habitability.
Yes, but let me say that to prepare for those possibilities is like saying hope for peace and prepare for war. If you prepare for war, you'll get war. For the end of civilization, you'll probably get it. And one of the things that we really want to emphasize is that many, many of the problems that actually threaten our whole civilization, the possibility of nuclear war, the possibility of terrorists with nuclear weapons, the possibility of climate destabilization, extinction of species, all these really huge disasters have a common link. And what is the thing that ties them together? It's that they are things that result from our using technologies that tap into the real powers of the universe while in our minds holding a 17th century picture of a universe that is completely inconsistent with these powers. We lack a cosmic context for what we're doing on Earth. One of the things, everyone has heard the phrase, think globally, act locally. Well, that's not enough anymore. What we need to start doing is think cosmically, act globally. If we want to solve these huge problems on Earth, we need to have some sort of a mental image of how the Earth fits into the larger context, how the long-term consequences of what humans are doing now are going to unfold. But without a cosmological scale of time, without understanding this new cosmology, we really can't wrap our minds around what we're already doing. So this, I think, is just of tremendous importance today, to realize that we need a cosmology, we need a shared picture of reality, and it has to be big enough to explain the meaning of the technologies that we're already using.
Well, I agree with you 100%. We don't know how things are going to work out, but, and you brought up the art and literature and science also. It would be a shame that whether it's a half a billion years or it's a thousand years, that we didn't have at least thoughts right now that, that could be through some satellite or some radio waves or something, that the knowledge that we thought we acquired would be out there. That would be, I wasn't talking specifically in negative terms. I'm kind of trying to talk in realistic terms that, things aren't going to last forever. So I just want, that question is haunting me for a long time, and I just wondered if science had thought about it and had, thought in a way that maybe all our knowledge could be passed on.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the call. We're at the point where we're going to have to finish, and I know Professor Primack, a little earlier you were talking about, for example, the fact that there is this stuff that constitutes a lot of the universe, and we've given it a name, but we don't know what it is. So so that may be one of the things you put on your list of questions that you really like to have an answer to. Are there a couple of other things that you think are the most tantalizing unanswered questions that we have now?
Let me tell you what I tell my graduate students at scientific conferences when people ask me that question. There are four big questions in cosmology today. One of them is, what sort of universe do we live in? And we're actually answering that question pretty well. We now know the parameters of the universe pretty well, how fast it's expanding, how large it is, how old it is, etc. And then the next question is, well, what's it made of? And we've talked about that, and our ignorance is profound. We now know that most of the universe is some kind of mysterious, invisible stuff, dark matter and dark energy, and we don't know what they are. But we know how to proceed. There are terrific experiments going on now, and I think the chances are very good we're either going to find out the answer to what's it made of, or we're going to rule out the current theories in the period of the next 5 years or so. How did it start, and what came before that? That's another one of the big questions. We're making progress on that one, too, and this is, after all, a golden age of cosmology. But that's a really tantalizing question. Mm-hmm. And the question that actually most astronomers spend most of our working time working on is none of those questions, surprisingly. It's the question of how the visible universe got to be the way it is. How did the galaxies turn into the beautiful spiral and elliptical shapes that we see around us? If we look at the early galaxies, the ones that Hubble Space Telescope shows us from the first couple billion years of the universe, you don't see anything that looks like the nearby galaxies. They just don't look like that at all. They're ragged. They are irregular in shape. They're forming stars at a furious rate. How do you go from that to these huge galaxies with their giant black holes in the center and their shapely forms that we see around us today? That's a question that we have a tremendous amount of data on, because not just Hubble Space Telescope, but a whole fleet